and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're switching things up as we're going to do once a month and look at how we put together the culture section of our cousin, sister and drinking buddy, Monocle magazine. Like good mathematics students, we're going to show our working. These are our notes in the margin. Let's shine a little light in upon magic. Is it magic? Not really. It's mainly just phone calls. Expect interviews then with writers, photographers, some of the cats here at Monocle Towers and some of the people we've met out on the road. The 100th issue of Monocle has just hit newsstands, so let's have a flick. That is what is coming up on Culture with me, Robert Bound. We'll begin with our lead culture story in this month's issue, a report about La Repubblica. This Italian daily newspaper is bucking the trend of sliding newspaper sales and providing hope for print. To find out how and why this Roman paper is thriving, we sent our Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, to La Repubblica's headquarters, where we met the team behind the title, and then to his local newsstand to find out who's reading what. And Ivan joins me on the line now. Ivan, thanks very much for joining us. This is the lead story in the culture section in issue 100, our February issue for this year. And it's a fascinating read. You really set the scene for La Repubblica and for the Italian press as a whole. Let's try and set the scene a bit to begin with. You go to La Repubblica. Does it feel like very much a place of work? I mean, there is perhaps something to do with the reputation of the newspaper. It's political stance and the seriousness with which it takes itself. Not po-faced necessarily, but it is doing a job of work serving the people of Italy and its readers, right?
Definitely. You know, when this newspaper started out just over 40 years ago, it was focused on politics and trying to offer a new voice to the more traditional, let's say, buttoned-up broadsheets. And there was no sports page or any of that sort of lighter sort of fare in the newspaper. And it's grown quite impressively, if you look at the numbers, over the years, and really become now Italy's leading daily. It's neck and neck in the last couple of months, but with Corriere della Sera here in Milan. But if you look at the past 3 or 4 years, they've really taken on the task of becoming the voice, or sort of the journal of record in Italy, and Corriere is trying to fight back. But I think because of the quality that you see in the pages of La Repubblica and also on their website, it's hard to argue that there is another paper of record. I mean, right now, the quality that's being led by Mario Calabrese in the newsroom is quite impressive.
So Mario Calabrese is the editor of La Repubblica and the chief designer, or a man brought in. Some listeners might know his name. He's done books. He's a big name in sort of graphic design circles, is Francesco Franchi, who worked his magic at Il Sole 24 Ore in Milan, a newspaper also that some of our listeners will be familiar with. Quite grand offices up there down the road from you, Ivan, in Milan. So with Signor Calabrese and Franchi, this is sort of a bit of a dream team. These are the kind of two sort of centre forwards, as it were, at the front of La Repubblica's team. How are they hoping to revolutionise or evolutionise the way the paper looks and feels and reads?
Well, Mario Calabrese is really a newspaper's man. I mean, you know, I've met him before, interviewed him for Monocle, when he was at La Stampa in Turin, where he ran the paper there. He's a big believer in photoreportage, and so he's brought that vision, his love for photography, which you see even in his office. I mean, there are some really impressive works there, World Press photo winners that decorate his office. And so he's wanted to bring a visual style of storytelling, you know, into the newspaper. There's a Monday to Friday feature called R2, which is quite interesting. It tells stories that are not just sort of topical, but can be subjects sort of out of the blue that he wants to focus on. And he's brought on Francesco Franchi. It was actually what's I think encouraging is that the art director at La Repubblica, Angelo Rinaldi, decided that they needed to up their game. And so, you know, he's lived at the paper for now 2 decades, and he wanted to bring in somebody with a fresh pair of eyes. And Franchi is someone he's 34, but he looks like he's just out of high school. And he's really done a remarkable job. If people have seen Il, which is this monthly magazine from the Financial Daily here in Italy. He's won awards, and he's lectured on the topic of bringing design into the pages of magazines and newspapers that can really up your sales. He really draws readers in, and you see that there is an interest when people see some of his work for the first time. You know, they say, wow, this is interesting. It's not something that I would expect now from newspapers today. They tend to sort of see them as quite dull, but he's able to bring color and different kinds of fonts, sizes, and working with a grid and really making it appealing so that you want to linger and browse through the pages.
And does it feel a lot different to the competition, to Corriere della Sera and La Stampa and the other Italian newspapers? Does it feel fresh? Can you see Franchi's hand on these pages, the supplements, and also the paper as a whole?
Yeah, right now his main task is working on a new cultural insert, because obviously the weekend is key for La Repubblica and also other papers. Mario Calabresi was telling me that, you know, right now in Italy, you know, you have to be sort of in a big sort of group, or you have to be a really small local paper to do well. Sort of the ones that are in the middle now are going to have problems. And so that's why, you know, you see consolidation. You see that La Repubblica is teaming up with La Stampa in Turin. And even though the titles will remain sort of independent, and for now the newsrooms, they won't cut staff, they'll share costs sort of in the back office and with printing. And so, you know, they have to deliver to readers who will have free time on the weekends, because they realize that the websites tend to get more eyeballs during the week. But they want to create these very appealing visual products for readers who have time. They have free time on the weekend, and so they can sit down with a paper and you know, crack it open and flip through it. And that's where Franchi was brought in for this cultural insert. And this thing is really an interesting piece of work, because it's not sort of the same old sort of staid literary review with book reviews and some film reviews and an interview with, say, an artist or a sculptor. They really sort of try to dig down and get into sort of more curious topics, looking at, for example, designs of, you know, LP records in the past. And also a thing that I'm a big fan of is signage in Italy. They have a regular column on talking about sort of the graphic work that you see in the beautiful signage in shops in Italy. And the way Franchi has presented the pages, it's sort of like a little magazine, in its own right. And the flow is basically like a magazine. And he plays around with fonts, and he's dug into the archives at La Repubblica. He showed me going back to sort of the early 80s, late 70s for ideas. And he says that it's sort of a vintage appeal to the vintage, sort of retro, because he sees that some people in their 30s who maybe don't pick up newspapers now, they might, you know, listen to LPs, vinyl. And so he's trying to appeal to them, as well as also making sure that the 60, 70-year-olds who read La Repubblica religiously from the first year aren't turned off either.
It'd be nice to take a little trip to the newsstand with you, Ivan, before we finish today. But just give us a little sense of an idea of the atmosphere between the protagonists here that you've told us about, between Calabresi and Franchi, and how this works. Because there's some really nice photography in this story, in the issue, of Frankie's notebooks, his a bit of his penmanship on the page, all the rest of it, some sketches for layouts for the newspaper and for the supplements. How does that work itself out? Is he in his little office on his own scribbling away, or is it quite a collegiate environment? Is there a lot of collaboration between words and pictures?
Well, Franchi works in the same office as Angelo Rinaldi, the art director. And both of them are gentlemen who like to work with pen and paper initially. Rinaldi has the task of setting up the front page. And so, you know, each day he's sort of sketching out the format, you know, where the photos will go and titles and whatnot. And the same with Franchi when he prepares ideas. For example, he was doing an infographic for the newspaper. It was looking at the 15th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan. But to make it in a way that is not heavy, but sort of bright in terms of the colors that he was using, he sketches out things and he creates this 15 numeral, which then becomes, it sort of morphs into various stats and graphs. And so it's a very clever way. You know, it's very sort of clever. And when you look at these people and sort of the deadlines that they're under, that, you know, every day and every week they have to pull together ideas, you know, it's amazing the way they're able to do that, you know, day in and day out, to really give a fresh sort of take on current events.
Okay, and as ever, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, Ivan. Let's take a trip to your local favourite newsstand. This is presided over by Fabrizio Prestinari. He's a bit of a mate of Monocle. He's been featured in the magazine once or twice over the years, hasn't he, in 10 years. And it was also very revealing. We photographed and interviewed briefly three people that rocked up to the newsstand to buy their papers when you were reporting, or the day after you got back from reporting this story. So what does it tell you? What do we learn from a trip to the newsstand in Milan, despite the fact we're profiling a Roman paper? Who's reading what and why? And maybe we'll start off by asking what reading La Repubblica says about you.
Well, I think, you know, again, one has to remember that today La Repubblica is really, you know, a national daily. I mean, if you look at Italy, Corriere, a bit La Stampa, but really it's La Repubblica and Corriere are the national dailies that you can find. And, you know, again, with Calabrese's work, it's become a paper that lots of people want to read, you know, in big city centers. And so even if you do talk to people in Milan, there, I find, actually, I was surprised to find more people who read La Repubblica regularly than Corriere. And that newsstand, Prestinari's newsstand, is about 50 footsteps from the newsroom of Corriere della Sera. So I think that's something that they may need to think about in terms of, you know, getting back readers. But talking to people and showing them the new culture insert that many had already seen, you know, it's that sort of visual style of presenting subjects, whether it's, you know, the opening of the La Scala opera season, or say a Zadie Smith interview, the way that Frankie doing different sizing and really playing around with fonts, and even getting some fonts specially designed, you know, for the insert, because they do have a bit of a budget. La Repubblica, they're lucky in that, and so they're able to get really creative on the page. And so today, you know, it's not surprising that you would find lots of readers of La Repubblica, you know, on the weekend. And here in Milan, when I look for that culture insert on the Sunday, you know, it sells out quite early on the Sunday, so you have to get up a bit earlier than one would want to on Sunday to make sure you get a copy. Otherwise, it's hard to find here.
Okay, Ivan, well, thank you very much for walking and talking us through the slightly austere but fairly stylish offices of La Repubblica in Rome, and taking us to your local newsstand, of course, in Milan. Ivan Carvalho on the line. Thank you very much. It's not just newspapers that are thriving in Italy. Book publishing isn't doing too badly either. Last year, we saw Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan novels boom around the world, helping contemporary Italian publishing to establish an international audience. But what's happening elsewhere in the industry? Italy has an incredible amount of publishing houses, somewhere like 4,000, in fact. So the ground must be pretty fertile for battling the online market. We sent our correspondent David Pleasant to the National Small and Medium-Sized Publishers Fair, it does exist, in Rome, to take the temperature of a remarkably buoyant industry, and found the time to look at some gorgeous books too.
There are two fundamental reasons why publishing is so important and so different here in Italy. One is historic, the communes, humanism, and the Renaissance that came before, the fact that much attention has always been given to the small territories, the small cities and towns. So there have always been many publishers that we identify as local because they dedicate themselves to enforcing the cultural assets in a particular location. In other words, they concern themselves in the geography that they find themselves in.
That was Antonio Monaco, president of Small Publishers at the Italian Association of Publishers, which is hosting the 15th rendition of the National Small and Medium-Sized Publishers Fair in the imposing surroundings of the Congress Palace in Rome's fascist-era EUR district. On paper, no matter how thick or well-printed, the event sounds somewhat stuffy, and one conjures up an image of kindly book and print shop owners in bow ties lamenting a distinct lack of customers. To the contrary, the atmosphere here is positively buzzing. Along with hundreds of individual publisher stalls, seminars, impromptu meetings, friendly counter-side espressos, and the odd musical band, make this fair, the only one of its kind in the world, a must for anyone who concerns themselves with Italian publishing. Back to Antonio.
The second reason is that we've created four or five big publishing groups that are not only publishers, but inside their operations have a network of bookshops. They have distribution networks, all the promotion. They basically have all the publishing services. They are total publishers, if you like.
How is this affecting small publishers on a day-to-day level? And how about other pressures? How has the dawn of digital affected the industry? Only one way to find out. I'm going out into the fair to meet some of the publishers.
We are Maria Pacini Fazzi Publishers. We have been active for 50 years. In fact, this is our 50th birthday, and we are from Lucca. The market for our books definitely exists. The fact that we have been going for 50 years and are still strong shows that there is space for us. Things are getting difficult, not because of the advent of digital, like everybody thinks. What is really damaging small publishers in Italy is our domestic big chains, and I won't name names. They are a closed shop, and it's virtually impossible to join the club and have your products sold there. Even once we enter, us small guys are not very visible.
So in many cases, trouble and fierce competition comes from within Italy and within the world of publishing. That said, unlike the situation in much of the rest of Europe and North America, in Italy, publishers and bookshops, independent and large chain included, are bustling and as are fully stocked as ever. And with a growth of 3.8% in sales of books published by small and medium-sized publishers in the year from 2015, there is reason for cautious optimism. Could digital, in fact, be spurring on the quiet growth of Italian publishing?
I'm Francesco. I work for a publishing house, Ediciclo, that is based in Italy. We are specialized in
Where in Italy, can I ask?
Oh, yeah, sure. In the province of Venice, in the east of the province. We are specialized in books about bicycles, so travel guides and travel literature. And we have opened the catalog recently to walking, so walking guides and walking literature.
We're looking at Parigi Londra, so that's Paris London cycling guide, and maybe it's interesting. Yeah. There's a fold out map.
Yeah, so you have this kind of special binding because you can read the guide
vertically,
then horizontally.
I'm describing for our listeners. Yeah. It's like a calendar, so
yeah.
It's got that binding,
spiral
binding that really allows you to fold it right back on its
when you are
back
cycling,
to back.
You can put it on the
handlebars.
handlebars. Yeah,
we can say that this is more reliable.
Yeah,
you're not dependent on battery or
when
or GPS or 4G and so on. So do you feel like there's, especially about your generation or our generation, do you feel like there's people coming back to print in a way that we didn't predict maybe 2 years ago when we thought this type of publishing was dead? Maybe it's not. Maybe it's the opposite.
I think in this kind of very specialized books, our generation is mixing the two solutions. So the book is always reliable and it's always present. Maybe it's not the easiest way, but very often is always mixed technology and book.
From foldable cycling guides to recipe books from Tuscany, the National Small and Medium-Sized Publishers Fair in Rome is showing the amazing breadth and diversity of this very dynamic sector. Unlike large, more mainstream publishing, it seems that this kaleidoscopic sector is largely immune from digital competition in the form of e-books.
This fair in Rome is special because we can meet people directly. And they can see with their own eyes the immense variety of small publishers. This variety is our strength. We are lots of little fish that make a richer sea.
For Monocle in Rome, I'm David Pleasant.
Thanks, David. We're going to move on now from Italian publishing to look elsewhere in the Feb issue of Monocle. One of my favourite bits of the culture section to write or commission each month is the close-up, which has a giggle up its sleeve at cultural figures from around the world. Over the years, we've featured people from Japanese TV stars to the cast of the new Baywatch movie. This month sees the turn of British adventurer, TV presenter, former soldier and jolly good egg, Bear Grylls. Here's how he went from Eton into the wild.
I'm Bear Grylls.
Woo!
I'm going to show you what it takes to get out alive from some of the most dangerous places
Woo!
On Earth. I've got to make it through a week of challenges and the sort of places you wouldn't last a day without the right survival skills. It might look idyllic, but every day in a place like this is a battle for survival.
Edward Michael, or Bear, Grylls was born in Northern Ireland in 1974. He moved to a cottage on the Isle of Wight at the age of four and grew up climbing trees and scrabbling over rocks. At 18, he joined the SAS, broke three vertebrae in a freefall parachuting accident over southern Africa aged 22, and, naturally, climbed Mount Everest just 18 months later.
I've skinned a dead seal to make a wetsuit and fashioned a dry bag from the remains of my life raft.
Tougher than your average bear, Grylls has wrestled alligators in the Everglades, swam stark naked across a freezing Siberian river, and curled up inside a camel carcass to keep cosy in the Sahara. His popular television series Born Survivor, or Man vs. Wild if you're outside the UK, first aired in 2006 and reached more than 1.2 billion viewers. But there was a bit of controversy.
Bite the head, give it a yank to break the neck. You'd be a bit careful doing this so that you don't get bitten yourself in the process.
The premise of Born Survivor was alone in the wilderness in far-flung places across the globe. Grylls had to get out alive with no more than a flint, a knife, and a water bottle. But in one episode, when our hero was ostensibly stranded on a desert island in Hawaii, he was in fact spending a few nights snug as a bug in a motel. Likewise, in the Sierra Nevada mountain range in California, we saw him biting the head off a snake for breakfast. What we didn't see was the heap of blueberry pancakes that he devoured in a resort at Bass Lake.
So the neck's broken. Okay, that's food.
But it's not all bad. In 2015, to help highlight the damaging effects of climate change, Grylls was joined in Alaska by Barack Obama for an episode of Running Wild with Bear Grylls. The two very tall men made tea from catkins, ate pre-chewed salmon, talked about fatherhood, and bonded over bear sex jokes.
The fact that he told me that this was a leftover fish from a bear, I don't know if that was necessary. He could have just left that out.
Now Bear Grylls lives with his wife Shara and their three sons. He divides his time between an old Dutch barge in London and a remote island off the coast of Wales, of course.
For more on Bear Grylls, head to the culture pages of the new issue of Monocle. Now, to finish the show, I want to talk about my favourite photograph that we shot for this edition. If you turn to pages 88 and 89 of Monocle, you'll find a profile on film distributor Dogwoof. On the right is a full-page image of the founders, Anna Godas and Andy Whittaker, overlooking London and shading each other from the sunlight. We found one of those days in London. This is an image that marks a change in the way Monocle is approaching photography. And to tell me a little bit more about it, who better than photo director Matt Beeman. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Nice to have you. Have you ever been in the studio?
This is my first time, actually.
What do you think about it?
I love it.
I mean, I've made the lighting in here fairly dim.
Yes, it's very,
obviously
yeah.
To make a romantic situation between the two of us. But how? I wonder how you shoot these studios, because they're quite photogenic, right?
Yeah, they are. Very low light conditions. I think you would have to use a very wide aperture. To let as much light in as possible, but to capture that mood, you wouldn't really want to use flash. You kind of want to see.
Okay. You want to see the full beauty of the,
you want to see the beauty,
presenting
as they
talent
yeah.
as, in all their glory. Yeah. Okay, so let's move to what we promised we were going to talk about, which is this shot of Dogwoof. Now, it's kind of weird. We're zeroing in on one shot from the issue here in the culture section, but it kind of marks what we're going to be doing from issue 101 onwards, doesn't it?
Yes.
Or it's a different vibe. Okay, so we come to you and we go, okay, I want to do a story on this film distributor. It's run by two people. Over the last 10 years of Monocle, we've shot lots of people in offices, sometimes more successfully than others. Although, you know, the photographers we use are always wonderful, nice people to work with, imaginative souls, all the rest of it. But what made you choose this way of doing this image for this story?
Well, this is the first time we've worked with this photography duo, Luke and Nick, two young guys in their early 20s. And their photography has a kind of, its roots in documentary photography, which is what we're all about. But they kind of twist that reportage, and I guess their style of reportage is a bit more considered and directed, so they might take people out of context and put them in different situations and direct them a bit more, and I think that's what they've done here.
So let's describe the image, actually. We've got Anna Godas and Andy Whittaker, who are the founders of Dogwoof, this great film distribution company that specialises in documentaries as well. So it's kind of a funny thing. They will understand what we're trying to do as photographers and writers themselves, which is a nice thing, which isn't always the case, I suppose. Mm. But they're standing on the balcony of Anna Godas' apartment, which I think is in one of the Barbican towers.
That's right, yeah.
So it looks out over London. It's a beautiful sunny day. It is a witty, charming image, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's what we're looking for in this new direction, to bring some humour to the photography. And sometimes in these situations, they can often be a bit dry, perhaps, and I think we're trying to just to inject that humour into these portraits is what we're trying to do.
Where, how do you brief a photographer? Because when I often work with photographers, what I like about working in tandem with someone, sometimes the way that stories work is I'll go first and then the photographer will go later or vice versa. It tends to work best when the writer and the photographer go together because, strangely, the photographer's always asked the best question. And sometimes the writer can get the photographer to point their camera in the right direction. And that's a nice thing about working in tandem. So how do you go about commissioning Luke and Nick for this story?
Well, most of our portraits, I would always ask the photographer to try to capture a moment which is not too posed or too artificial feeling, or maybe try to catch the moment just after they've posed or in conversation, or just try to find the most relaxed moment possible, I guess.
And to try to obviously get the personality of the subject out.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, it's one of those things. If two people are posing against a wall, then they're looking straight to camera, but it's the point at which they're touching up their makeup or they're asking each other if they look okay. That's what we want in the future, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're choosing a photographer, does it help that you've met them so that you know the kind of person they are, that they can be... There's a certain amount of charm involved in getting the best out of subjects photographically, isn't there?
Yeah. Luke actually was an ex-intern of mine from a previous job. And I think...
So you got it done for free. That's good.
Yeah. But I think portrait photographers, that's a quality which is really important in that situation. I think to be able to help people relax and get the best out of them, you need a certain way of being. And I think... Yeah, I'll always try to meet people before commissioning them.
So this is a story in the culture section. Obviously, that's what we're talking about today. Does this kind of new style of photography, will it seep through all the pages of the magazine? I mean, what happens when you've got the president of a country or a big businessman or someone in a soldier in a risky situation? How does that work out?
I think in those situations, that's when it's most important. I think to try to find these moments and instances with politicians and CEOs of big businesses, that's where we really need that injection of humour and irreverence, I guess. But I think in terms of across the whole board, in other sections of the magazine, I think we'll probably stay the same. It might not suit every portrait that we do or every section of the magazine.
And also, on the subject of Luke and Nick, it's pretty rare that people work in tandem. Yeah. Obviously, photographers often have assistants that set up the light, and if they need a lighting rig and all the rest of it, just simply in order to change memory cards and all that stuff if you're shooting fast. I've seen a lot of that in 10 years of working at the magazine.
Yeah.
But it's rare that both people get their name on the photo credit. How do they work?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there are a few duos, like Mert and Marcus, the famous fashion photographers. They work in a similar way. And I guess similar to these guys, they shoot a lot of fashion as well. And I think it's an interesting way of working. It's more of a discussion between the two of them about how they should shoot something. And they'll kind of swap cameras between the two of them. And yeah, it is.
So it's not just down to the person that presses the button.
No, and I think, I don't know who actually pressed the button on this image, but they would never distinguish between the two of them. And it was a joint creative job.
I like that.
It's interesting. Yeah.
In my head, they're kind of like Jedward.
Yeah, yeah, kind of.
let that not spoil the listener's pleasure. All right, well, that was Matt Beaman. Thank you very much indeed, Matt, for your maiden voyage down to the radio studios. The way the culture show is going to work moving forward, also, it might mean that you turn up a little more often, Dan.
Okay, I look forward to it.
I think it's gone well so far.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
Well, that brings us to the end of the show. If any of this has piqued your interest, then be sure to beg, steal, borrow, or buy your February edition of Monocle magazine, which is out in shops now. Or head to monocle.com and sign up for a very good value subscription. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was always the front page, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound. Thank you very much for tuning in.